for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Anna Quinlan is a New York Times bestselling author. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Her latest book, Every Last One, is a novel which had me totally into it from the minute I picked it up yesterday until I finished it yesterday afternoon. It's quite a story. And what we'll have to do here, Anna, is to be very careful not to give away too much of the plot. Anna Quinlan is here in the studio. You can join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. How good to see you.
I know. It's great to be here again. This is always a high point of book tour for me.
Oh, Anna, you're dear. Now, the central character of your book, Mary Beth, is a wonderful mother. Somebody that I found myself thinking, she is so understanding of each of those kids. She's got twin boys. She's got a 17-year-old girl whose name is Ruby. I could not stop reading. Extraordinary. And I found myself wondering where this plot came from in you. It was an unexpected one.
You know, it's so funny to say this because there's none of this event in this book in any way, shape, or form. But I think it probably began to germinate on September 11th, 2001.
Really?
Because all of us, but particularly those of us in New York City, I think began to think so much about the randomness of tragedy, about the fact that you would arbitrarily decide to take one flight rather than another.
Right.
Or go to a breakfast at Windows on the World, or go to a job interview at a brokerage house. And it would mean the difference between life and death. And it made me think so much about the fact that in modern America, we convince ourselves that we have a kind of a control over our safety that is completely illusory. I mean, we have all these hedges against disaster. We have seat belts, we have childproof caps, we have burglar alarms, and so on and so forth. And what we forget is that life is so random and so various. And like a kaleidoscope, if the pieces mesh in one fashion, things will be fine. And if they don't, disaster may ensue. And that was the germ of this book.
There's another element here, which is that sometimes we do not see what is right in front of us.
Well, I think that's true because there are so many moving parts to what's right in front of us. I mean, Jim Carrey put out this stupid tweet this weekend where he said something about Tiger Woods' wife and how she must have known what was going on. And I thought, oh, you are so foolish. I have known so many spouses who didn't know what was going on. I've known so many parents who said after the fact, but we never knew he or she was doing this or that. You know, people are mysterious. I mean, the essence of fiction is that people are mysterious. And I think this all went into thinking about a situation in which a woman is trying so hard to be a good mother and to calibrate care versus independence, which is always a difficult calibration with teenagers. wondering all the time whether she's getting it right, and sometimes realizing that she's getting it wrong.
And with these twin boys, for example, Alex and Max, she's got two very, very different personalities. One who's quite outgoing, has lots of friends. The other who's really far more internal. And she's thinking she probably gives too much attention to one and not enough to the other. She looks at her 17-year-old daughter, Ruby, as kind of a soulmate. Her husband, Glenn, is an ophthalmologist, doesn't talk too terribly much. They have fun together. Everything is good. And one has to begin to wonder where the seeds begin to be planted in that or any family.
I think that's true in every tragedy that we see, that from the outside frequently life does look good. People do seem to have it together. And then just something random happens. I mean, look, I've been a reporter, I've been a columnist, I've been a novelist, and I've been the mother of three children. And there's no question in my mind that day to day, in terms of concentration, in terms of balancing various interests, in terms of introspection, the motherhood job was the most challenging job for me. And I think that's true for a lot of people I know.
Also in this book, there's a lot about friendship and the importance of friendship.
I couldn't get by without my girlfriends.
Nor could I.
And, you know, one of the things, the Wall Street Journal last week had an excellent piece about male friendships and how different they are from female friendships, and about how one of the guys said, our friendships are about doing stuff, not talking about stuff. Well, my friendships with my female friends are all about talking about stuff and hashing stuff over and getting it right. And I think what you see in this book is that there's no way that Mary Beth could make it to the end of this story without the help of her girlfriends.
Talk about her friend Alice, who in the beginning seems as though she's kind of she's not a very experienced woman with a very young child.
Right. She calls out of the clear blue sky all the way, all the time, and says things like, what does chicken pox look like?
Yeah.
Or how long should they have a pacifier? Things like that. And, you know, they're out of sync at this moment. They've been college roommates, very close friends. But in that way that sometimes we are with friends, you know, one of us has a high-powered job, one of us doesn't.
Quite right.
One of us has small children, one of us doesn't. Sometimes we get out of sync. And one of the things this book made me think about was about how friendships are often situational. We're friends with someone for 30 years only because the housing authority at a college assigned us to the same room when we were 18. Or we're friends with someone because our children were in kindergarten
or
together.
Or Sunday school.
Exactly. And then sometimes those friendships fall apart because that situationality is not enough to hold it together. And there's some of that in this book as well.
And, of course, Ruby has girlfriends, but she also has a boyfriend, Kiernan,
right,
whom she's known since kindergarten. Talk about Kiernan.
Well, I think a lot of us have the kid who seems to have come to stay. In our house, he's this wonderful boy named Morgan. He's actually a young man now. And recently my husband said, when we were filling out the census form, do we count Morgan? Because he spends so much time at our house and we love him so much. The problem is in those situations, and we've lived through this as parents, sometimes your entire family embraces a kid and then your kid decides that they don't want to be with that kid anymore. And that is a challenge.
And, of course, that's precisely what happens with Ruby. She decides that the relationship with Kiernan is over. Kiernan has a really hard time with that.
Because he hasn't just had a relationship with Ruby. He's had a relationship with the entire Latham family. And I think that happens frequently. And then you're asking the kid not only to break off a teenage love affair, but to unmoor himself from a family that, in essence, has become a second family for him.
When that second family really stands in the stead of the first family.
Exactly.
Especially because Kiernan's family life is not great.
Right. And I think frequently we experience this as parents. You know, the kids who cycle through our lives and use us as surrogate parents, and we frequently wonder what we owe to them, especially if our kid becomes less attached to them than perhaps even we are.
Anna, you have now decided to stop writing your column for Newsweek as of 2009. How come?
I've been doing that for 9 years, which is the longest I've ever held any job. And as I said in the last column I wrote, those of us who are baby boomers are taking up a lot of space in the professional pipelines. Maybe it's time to give the younger people a chance.
Anna Quinlan, her new novel is titled Every Last One. Do join us by phone, by email, send us a tweet, join us on Facebook. Just before the break, Anna Quinlan was talking about the fact that she has decided to leave her column at Newsweek after 9 years of writing it. Here's an email from JC in Gaithersburg, Maryland. She says, I want to express my appreciation of Anna. I've read her commentary in Newsweek for years. Her ability to put thoughts and emotions into words that so clearly express a view is extraordinary. And I think you did exactly the same thing in your commencement address to Wesleyan. Talk about that.
Oh, that was one that was close to my heart because my second child, my son Christopher, graduated from Wesleyan, and I have a great deal of respect for the place. But it was at a moment, really, when the economy was at its lowest ebb. All we were hearing about was home foreclosures. And I knew I was supposed to apologize to these young people for the world we were sending them out into. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that I felt just the opposite, that we had made such a hash of everything that they were going to have to reinvent all kinds of institutions and jobs and ways of living, and that that was such an exciting opportunity that I thought that they were really going to have a chance to do something that all of us would want to do. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I said just before the break, send us a tweet, and you took off with a riff on tweets.
Well, I mean, it's astonishing to me. My last book tour for a novel for Rise and Shine was 4 years ago. First principles of a book tour have changed radically in just 4 years. There's much more emphasis on certain websites. A website, for example, called Goodreads.com that apparently is hugely influential. Bloggers who review your book. A program called Amazon Vines, where they send out bound galleys to certain readers and they review the book before it's even appeared. An entire way of dealing with readers and interfacing with them that just didn't even exist 4 years ago. It's kind of remarkable to me.
And restaurant reviews, same thing.
Well, Howie Kurtz has a terrific, I think it's Howie. Oh, I hope I'm not getting this
wrong. I'm sure.
Has a terrific piece in today's Washington Post that says, look, will there be newspaper and magazine reviewers in the future? If you can go online on Monday morning and see what 300 people thought of a movie that you were thinking of seeing, will you read one critic for the New York Times or the Washington Post? And I thought it was such an interesting argument to think about that.
And will you be more in tune with those people who tweet or the critic of the New York Times in terms of your own feelings about that movie?
Well, the one thing I would say is we do have a tendency to have an either-or mentality in America.
True.
I just wrote this piece for Newsweek about the fate of the book on paper. And we do tend to think, okay, you know, we have audiobooks, so no one's going to buy hardcover. Not true.
Not.
We have television, therefore no one's going to listen to radio.
Not.
Exactly. We have movies, no one's going to go to plays. Not. I think we can absorb a variety of platform delivery systems, as they call them now, and I just realized I really have no idea what that means.
Do you own a Kindle?
I do not own a Kindle.
Nor do I.
But I gave my husband one for Christmas.
You did.
And he loves it.
He loves it.
And I made sure that the Kindle edition of every last one is out first thing tomorrow at the same time the hardcover edition hits the store.
That's
because
great.
I don't want to deny Kindle readers.
But, you know, I still love holding a book. There's just no question of it. And I know people keep saying to me, but just think how quickly you could have the book in front of you that you wanted in an instant.
Well, there's two different feelings I have about this. One is I was reading a piece about how in Japan children have virtual pets on their computer. They have a dog and they let the dog out in the morning. I have two Labradors. I like actual Labradors as opposed to Labradors on computers. And I sort of feel the same way about a book. However, not long ago, I was in an airport and I ran out of book, which for me is a fate worse than death. And I was looking for a book kiosk and all they had were the most dreadful things.
Yeah.
And I wound up reading something on a plane that was making me hate myself in the morning. And I thought, this is where you need a Kindle.
Interesting. And an awful lot of people you do see now on planes with Kindles. Tell me where you're getting your news these days.
In the morning, I read 4 or 5 newspapers, actual newspapers, newspapers that get your hands dirty. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Daily News, the New York Post. Then once I start working, I go upstairs and I go to various websites. I go to the Huffington Post. I go to Daily Kos. I keep up with the website of the New York Times in case there's breaking news during the day. I read the Washington Post online. I read the Daily Beast. I do read Gawker. People deny it. I won't. A variety of other places. I read the Financial Times every day, but usually online. And then in the evening, I actually read books on paper.
What about radio?
Oh, I mean, I'm an indefatigable. I want to say this. NPR donor, which is really important because
absolutely.
You get what you pay for.
You
and an indefatigable listener. And one of the things that I love most about satellite radio is that you can get, look, I love classical music, but when I'm driving, I like to listen to people talk about things I'm interested in. And to have that opportunity to listen to all of those great shows on one channel is just fantastic. And this gives me an opportunity to say something I'm so excited to say, which is that you've won the Peabody, one of the most prestigious awards in the business. And I am astonished that you've never won it before, since you're kind of the gold standard of talk radio. But I'm so excited to be able to tell your listeners who love you so much that you have won the Peabody and you're going to go to New York and get it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, aren't you totally chuffed about
this? Just totally over the top about it.
It's
just
fantastic.
Couldn't be happier. And, you know, my manager and my senior producer and a whole bunch of people were in that studio with the engineer pointing to my screen to try to tell me I had won. There was nothing I could see on the screen. And finally it came up and said, "You've won the Peabody." So I was really thrilled.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. You are not reading, except for newspapers, much nonfiction these days, are you?
It depends on the moment. There was sort of a flurry of things that I read nonfiction at the beginning of the year. Too Big to Fail, which is a terrific, terrific book about the underpinnings of the financial crisis. Game Change, which got so much ink for kind of the gossipy stuff.
That's why I was worried about
People would say to me, "I feel like I've already read it." I kept saying, no, you haven't. It's a really sophisticated look. If Ben Cramer's What It Takes, which is the best book about any campaign, hadn't existed, this would be close to the top of the list. And then I read a nonfiction book called The Whale, about whales, which happens to be something that I'm really interested in. But I'm a pretty consistent fiction reader. And the whole time I'm on tour, I have a stack of about 8 or 10 books that are going with me, and they're all fiction at this
point. That's what my pleasure is at night before I go to bed, is just reading fiction. So pleasurable. Mm. What about Facebook and Twitter? Are you on them?
I am not. I promised my children years ago that I would not go on Facebook so that they could sort of have their privacy on Facebook or not be forced to refuse to let me friend them or whatever it is. And I asked the kids about Twitter and they said, "Mom, do you want to be more accessible to people?" I said, "No, I'm a writer. I want to be less accessible except through my books." And they said, "Well, if you don't want to be any more accessible, don't Twitter." So I'm not Twittering.
You know, one of the things about every last one is that the family is really an ordinary family. They live an ordinary life. They have friends. They have neighbors, they have picnics, they have book sales, they are heroine. Mary Beth owns a gardening, a landscape business, and she's got lots of people working for her. She is very valued in the community, but it's a slower paced way of life. And there are an awful lot of people who believe our way of life, because of all this communication, rapid communication, is moving way too quickly. How do you see it?
I think there's this weird juxtaposition of all of this real time. I'm IMing my daughter about what's going on at an award ceremony. She's sitting out of college and she's IMing me back. Overlays a life that in many ways is very much the same as it's been for a long time. Those same sort of loving connections, those same sort of family events, those same sort of connections among parents and children. I mean, I always think of the weird juxtaposition of our kids who, you know, as teenagers seem to know a good deal more about sex than we ever did, including some stuff that I still am not sure I know, and are often talked about as having very profligate sex lives and the like. And then I see two 16-year-olds fall in love, and it's exactly like 16-year-olds have fallen in love since Romeo and Juliet.
Okay, but take a look at it from a slightly different perspective. Take a look at it from the vantage point of the town meetings that took place over the past year, looking at health care and the vehemence that was expressed at those town meetings. What's happened there? Now, juxtapose that to the ordinariness of the family.
Well, I think a lot of different things are going on with the town meetings. And I do think that it's always important to remember that what we see with kicking and screaming at events like that tends to be, at some level, the margins. Now, I'm not talking about marginal people. I'm talking about for every person who's standing in a microphone screaming about Obamacare, you have a vast undistributed middle of Americans who aren't going to town meetings, who aren't screaming, and who are sitting at home saying,
"What's
I'm not
going
sure
on
if
here?
I'm for this or against yeah. this. I don't really understand this." I do think that there is a deep dis-ease in America at this moment. And sometimes I think it's because many people sense intuitively that we may be at the end of the American century, that the 100 or 125 or 150 years when America bestrode the world and was clearly the only dominant force at some level, in the same way that the Brits were in the 19th century, may, because of globalization, because of porous borders, because of an international economy, may in some sense be coming to an end. And that makes us very uncomfortable.
Anna Quinlan, her new novel is titled Every Last One. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. As you talk about the end of the American century, what about the Roman Catholic Church and what's happening there?
Oh, this makes me so sad to talk about. And I'm so glad that my friend and former colleague Maureen Dowd has really taken up the cudgels on behalf of outspoken Catholic women everywhere and Catholics everywhere.
She did so in yesterday's New York Times.
And has done a whole series of really right. terrific columns. I just feel very sad. I feel very sad for all the lay people and nuns and priests who have done and are doing such good work around the world, who have been overshadowed by the most ham-handed hierarchy, which instead of dealing with morality seems to have mainly been dealing with legality and damage control. As a Catholic, it kind of breaks my heart.
Now, what about the Vatican? What about the way it has dealt with this? Ham-handed is one way to put it. Looking at the legal issues is another way. There are people around the world saying the Pope should step down.
It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. I mean, they may be running things right now as though they're doing a losing political campaign, but the truth of the matter is they think of themselves as above earthly concerns. I mean, if they've managed all these years to ignore the fact that they have fewer and fewer priests, and the obvious way to help with that issue is to ordain both married people and women who feel called by God to serve in that way, then they're not going to respond to matters like this by having the Pope step down.
Do you believe that they may move to married priests?
They will move to married men before they'll move to women.
Yes.
I think misogyny and ignorance of what women are all about run so deep in the institutional church that it would be far more threatening to them to ordain women than to ordain married men.
But doesn't that go back historically? They did not want the property of the church going to wives or children. And that was why they called for non-married men.
Well, you know, I have great respect for the Episcopal Church. I think they've led the way in social justice for many, many years, and somehow they've managed to work this out.
Absolutely. Anna Quinlan, her new novel is titled Every Last One. When we come back, we'll take every last one of your phone calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working with low-income families to claim tax credits and achieve economic stability, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
In the next Fresh Air, Peter Wolf on his life and music career, including fronting the Jay Giles Band and getting to know some iconic blues musicians.
James Cotton would cook up all sorts of chicken, and Muddy would tell Howlin' Wolf, hey, you know, there's this young guy has an apartment, so he would come by. John Lee Hooker would come by, and they would just all hang.
Wolf has a new solo CD. Join us. Don't try to explain, because
I don't
And if you've just joined us, Anna Quinlan is with me. She is, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, writer. She is also a very, very successful novelist. Her latest is titled Every Last One. Here's an email from Tim, who says, please comment on the sadness that accompanies the drifting apart of childhood friends. By that, I mean sadness on the part of parents as the relationships our children have evolve. But we still have soft spots for the relationships that were. Children seem less affected than we do.
First of all, that's a huge part of this book,
yeah.
Because you get the sense that Mary Beth holds on to the relationship with Kiernan far past the point that her daughter does, but also far past the point at which it's good for her daughter to do so. But boy, have we lived through that. I mean, our kids have had friends, and in some cases, particularly with our sons, girlfriends that we've become so attached to, that have become so much a part of our family. It's so hard for us to let go of them. I remember one of the boys saying to me, "Mom, you've just got to break up with her."
Interesting. To Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest if she could clarify what you were saying when you talked about, do you think that the baby boomers could get out of some younger folks take over?
Well, I felt that very strongly in my own realm, which is being an opinion columnist. I felt like I was hearing too few voices of people in their 20s and 30s and 40s opining. Being an opinion columnist is a great, great job. And what happens is that people tend to hang on to it. And one of the reasons that I gave up my column at Newsweek was because I felt like I needed to make room for younger people. This, of course, was not a popular stance with some of my readers in their 50s and 60s. But I was in a position to be able to do it. And I decided that it was something that I wanted to do.
And here's another email on that very issue who says, it's from Joan, who says, "Well, I appreciated your view of taking up a slot that someone younger should have. I wonder who is going to be the voice for me, a white middle-class mother in my 50s.
Well, you know, Joan, I think maybe the reason I'm hypersensitive to this is that 20-some years ago, I was the voice for white middle-class mothers in their 30s when I wrote a column called Life in the 30s. And when I wrote that column at the New York Times, the outpouring from people much like me was essentially, oh my God, finally somebody speaking for us. And one of the things that would be so great about punditry, and one of the openings that I think the internet and the blogs and the e-zines is surging into is this sense that all different kinds of groups would like to have a voice, would like to have somebody who speaks for them.
Sure.
And I think that that's more possible than ever before because of some of the online journals. Because let's face it, there are only so many spots on the op-ed page of the New York Times or the Washington Post.
So you've got lots of opportunities in other ways, is what you're saying.
And also you have lots of opportunities to prove yourself for some of those bigger venues. So that I think when the New York Times is deciding next time to fill one of those slots on the op-ed page, they should be paying more attention to younger people who may be writing online content at this moment.
Now to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, John.
Hey. Ms. Quinlan made the comment about the town meetings, about the people talking at microphones and thinking that for each one standing there, there was a lot of people that didn't have those views or didn't know what their view was. I think for every person standing there at the microphone, they were representing more people than I think she's talking about. And if you look at polls, most people were against Obamacare. Even after the sales job, more people are against it now than when it passed. And as someone that listens to Rush Limbaugh and Diane Rehm, I thought that your listening and blog habits sounded pretty far left.
Oh, I would totally agree with you that my listening and blog habits are very far left. And I try to balance them a little bit by watching Bill O'Reilly and Hannity in the evening. I tend to switch in between Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann and Hannity and Bill O'Reilly, which sometimes makes me feel like my head is going to explode, actually.
I feel the same way about Keith Olbermann.
But I would say to you that I'm going to be much more interested in the poll results on the health care reform bill when people start to benefit from it. And in my family, we're already going to be able to benefit from it because we have kids who are graduating from college who would have been hanging out there without any health insurance. But because of the provisions of the health care reform bill, we'll be able to keep them under our plan until they're 26. And my husband and I are both delighted about that.
Thanks for calling, John. To Stephanie, she's in Miami, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Anna, I know you didn't write your book, Every Last One, just for me, but it feels very much like you did.
How come, Stephanie?
My best friend was Elizabeth Yeh, who served with you on the board at Barnard College. And I want to tell you, first of all, that she absolutely adored you and would give me every last book that you wrote as soon as it came out. But the way you describe the ebbs and the flows of a 30-year friendship, and even the grief that accompanies all of the joy in being close to someone as you learn to let go and then come back together again, it's so spot on for me. And, you know, as I struggle, because Elizabeth died 2 years ago, as I struggle to rebuild my life and my close friendships, you know, I acknowledge and honor the fact that she and I could stick with it for so long through the ebbs and the flows, and just wonder if that's even possible for me now as a 43-year-old woman to have another friendship like that again. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what your thoughts are about those close friends that you build as a child versus those that you become close to as an adult.
Well, I actually think there's a lot of possibilities for later in life friendship, and I keep encountering them. The problem that I have is that I keep saying to my husband, oh, I love her, but I don't have time for any more friends.
Yeah.
And every time I say that, it turns out that I become friends with somebody that I didn't expect to become friends with. And the other thing that I found really really wonderful at this stage of my life, I'm 57, is that I've developed really close female friendships with a couple of women who are materially younger than I am. And that's a whole different kind of friendship because they look to me for support and advice of a kind that I don't necessarily give my friends who I've been friends with for 30 or 35 years. With them, it's much more of a sounding board. Mm. You know, I unload on Janet. Janet unloads on me. So I think that there are possibilities, but there's something about somebody who's known you forever that's very, very powerful.
But you know the idea about your friendship with Elizabeth Yeh has come up in a number of emails and now this caller. Tell us about her.
Well, Liz was on the Barnard board and she just was kind of the most wonderful, sunny, terrific young mother imaginable. She, in fact, at the time that I put her on, well, we put her on the board of trustees that at Barnard, which I chair, she was, I think, our youngest alum on the board. And so she brought that kind of vitality and perspective. She's just a wonderful person. And actually one of the there are two terrific things about Liz's legacy. The first is that we have a new student center at Barnard, which has a cafe called Liz's Cafe that's named after her. And the second is that her husband, Ravi, is now on the board in her stead.
She died quite young.
Yes, about 2 years ago.
Ah, I'm sorry. Thanks for calling, Stephanie. To, let's see, Big Pine, Florida. Good morning, Kathleen.
Hello, Anna.
Yes, Kathleen.
Oh, I'm sitting out in the sun listening to your wonderful discourse. I have a small independent bookstore in northern Wisconsin and will be going up there in a month to open up again. And I can't wait to get your book. I'm thrilled to have your other books. I loved Rise and Shine. I just want to know, your novel ideas are fabulous. And like you, I love fiction. I will promote your book as an independent bookseller. I want to know, do your family or friends ever mind that you kind of use them, or do you really not? not use them in your stories. Thanks so much.
All right.
I don't use them. I would say that, like most novelists, I started out in the territory of semi-autobiography and moved away. So Object Lessons, my first novel, is the most autobiographical, and certainly every last one is the least. My oldest son copy edited this book for me, did the last copy edit after the copy editors at Random House had done it. And he said, oh, Mom, I can't wait till Maria reads this, because the relationship between Mary Beth and Ruby reminds me a little bit of your relationship with Maria when she was in high school. And I said, son, that's because it's not like my relationship with Maria. It's like the relationship that every mother has with a 17-year-old daughter.
17-year-old, of course. And, you know, I could identify with that kind of relationship with one's daughter. My daughter is now 45 years old, but remembering back to that 17-year-old period, wow. To Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Yes.
I wanted to ask your visitor if she agreed with me that this fact, as stated by the previous caller, that, quotes, the American people were against Obamacare, is really not at all true. It's probably the way they frame the question when they did the results of their survey, because when you ask them individually about the parts of the Obamacare, they all agreed with it. And I just want to know your guest's opinion on this.
Sure. My first opinion is that, having lived through the 2008 presidential election, I will never put much credence in polls again. My second opinion is that I've seen polls that showed a 50-50 split. I've seen polls that showed a 50-30-20. I've seen polls that showed an enormous chunk of people who said, don't know enough about it to make. But again, I do think that at one point I was giving a speech and someone asked me what I thought about it and whether I was for the public option. And I said, yeah, I would support a public option. Here's what the public option is. Instead of getting Medicare at 65, you get it at 40.
Exactly.
And someone in the audience said, how come no one else has explained this like this? Well, I think there was a lot of misinformation about this. I think it was a big bill. It was hard to wrap your mind around. I look forward to hearing people talk about health care reform when it has become an accepted fact of American life. You know, the American people were crazed about Social Security at one end of the political spectrum when it was first proposed by the president. It was seen as communism. It was seen as socialism, the redistribution of wealth. Now they act as though Social Security is a constitutional God-given right. We have a way of taking what seem like liberal, even radical, positions and completely absorbing them into the fabric of the American spirit. And I have no doubt that that's what will happen to health reform.
Pete, thanks for calling. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You know, Anna, we're doing a program tomorrow on taxes and taxation. I'm sure you know that only 47% of the American population pays taxes.
I do know that, and I'm actually part of that 47%, and I'm part of the group that pays at the highest rate. And you know what? I think you get what you pay for.
You bet.
I think you get what you pay for. And I'm happy to pay taxes for the right thing. And also, the whole idea that I shouldn't have to pay for things I don't agree with. I didn't agree with the invasion of Iraq. I don't agree with capital punishment, but you know, your tax dollars get put in a big pot and then they get spent the way your elected officials
see
fit.
But what about the other 53%? What happens there?
Well, first of all, we have an enormous number of people in this country who are living below or at the poverty line. I don't want those people to pay taxes. I want them to be able to keep their homes. I want them to be able to feed their kids. I want them to be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So I can live with that. I think the problem with taxation in the United States is not so much about individuals. It's about corporations. And that's another issue that I hope you'll go into for another day.
Absolutely. And the president's statement at his State of the Union address and Justice Alito's look and statement at the time.
Well, we'll see how this all plays out. I am deeply interested in who will be the next justice on the Supreme Court and how they'll be able to hold Justice Kennedy.
How they'll be able to hold Justice Kennedy will be a very interesting question. Anna Quinlan, her latest novel, absolutely first rate, is titled Every Last One. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on the Peabody Award.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.